Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This episode is brought to you by Lifetime's Robin Roberts Presents Mahalia. From executive producers Robin Roberts and Linda Berman comes the biopic of the legendary Mahalia Jackson. Grammy Award winner Danielle Brooks stars as the trailblazer whose music moved, inspired, and changed people's hearts. Critics have praised Brooks's transformative performance into the Queen of Gospel as thunderingly good. Directed by Kenny Leon and written by Bettina Jilliwa and Todd Kreidler, this Lifetime original movie continues to inspire viewers and highlights the ongoing fight for social justice. Robin Roberts presents Mahalia for your Emmy consideration in all categories. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Deadline's New Hollywood Podcast. My name is Dino Ray Ramos, and on today's episode of the pod, we have the incredible Sierra Teller-Ornelas, who is the co-creator and executive producer of Rutherford Falls on Peacock, just singular, guys. I'm just going to say that this show is long overdue. This is the first, first native-centered show on television, comedy at least, where native characters, native actors lead, write. They pretty much do everything, and it's such an incredible show. Sierra did a dope job with this. You may know, Sierra has also worked on other shows like Superstore, Happy Endings, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, so she has a good track record. So, and you know what? This show is just pretty dope and fun. And you learn something because of, you know, we've learned a lot of wrong things about the Native community. And Rutherford Falls, you know, sets us straight. So without further ado, here is Sierra Teller-Ornelas.
Sierra, welcome to Deadline's New Hollywood Podcast. We are happy to have you on. So obviously you are the creator of Rutherford Falls, which if you guys haven't seen it on Peacock, it's a joy. Oh my goodness. I binged it. Like I could not stop watching it. You worked on shows like Happy Endings, which was another really great show. Yes. That ended too soon. And Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Superstore, and then you have your own show right now, just doing amazing things. But let's start from the beginning for you. Like I know
the
you,
very beginning, birth.
So you grew up in Arizona, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So what brought you to storytelling? Inspired you to become a storyteller?
Before I start, yat a Sierra Nellis yin shi, tabahenishle, nikaidinet abashishchi, tuahaglini dishache, do nikaidinet additionally. My name is Sierra. I'm a member of the Navajo Nation. I am Edgewater clan, born for the Mexican clan. Thank you so much for having me here today. I am a co-creator and I'm a co-creator, showrunner of Rutherford Falls currently. I was born in Phoenix, raised mostly in Tucson. I lived throughout New Mexico and Arizona. My dad had like a million jobs before he settled on pharmacy. And so, but I come from a long line of storytellers. My mother's maiden name is Teller because the story that I was told is that when Navajos were interned during the Long Walk, which is like kind of our Trail of Tears, they put us all in this camp at this fort called Bosque Redondo and gave us all Christian names. Mm. And so they asked my like great great grandfather what his job was, and he said I'm a storyteller, and so like that's actually why my middle name is Teller. And then my great grandfather was born on the way back when we were all able to return to our homelands. And so to me, like, you know, when like Taika Waititi did his Oscar speech saying, you know, we are the original storytellers, I really do believe like this is like a traditional way of working that has kind of been passed down in my family. Everyone in my family loves to tell a good story and loves to be entertaining. And I sort of had one of those weird childhoods where like comedy was rewarded. So like if I was funny, I could get out of trouble, I could get out of homework, I could get out of a lot of stuff. And my dad always wanted to be like a stand-up comedian, and my mom was an Indian artist. And so we spent a lot of time sort of, Jana Schmieding, who is plays Regan on our show, always says that all Native people for some reason are like weird, like kind of, we're all like historians, like not always by choice, and that we're always sort of expected to educate people about who we are and Native people as a whole. And yeah. So I do think that kind of always lends itself to storytelling.
Yeah. And obviously being from your community, I'm curious, you know, we like to ask our guests a lot, especially people that sort of like, I guess what when was the first time you kind of can remember being seen on TV and film, like you're like an authentic representation of where you're from, your community, all that stuff. What was that? Do you have or do you recall when you first saw that sort of representation on TV, like growing up or film?
You know, that's really, yeah, I get that question a lot. It's such a hard thing to answer because I love television so much, and I really saw myself in every single character on TV. Like I remember, you know, when I was little, cable TV had just started. And so it was like, they would put anything on. It was like hours of shows from the 60s. And it was like Marlo Thomas and That Girl, or like Laverne and Shirley. And I remember watching that and being like, that's gonna be me. I'm totally gonna like have an apartment and be single and have adventures and like Bewitched. Like I really was able to kind of see myself in all of those characters. And it never really occurred to me that I wasn't on screen. And even like The Godfather, like there's, you know, my parents always use quotes from that movie as like a way of life, which is kind of scary. But then I think once Dances with Wolves came out in 1991 or 1990, can't remember when that came out, but yeah. it was like a revelation in the sense of everyone started to see me as Native. And it was like, I was expected to sort of perform. And there were questions of like, did you like live in a teepee? Or did you, you know, just like people's kind of, people's non-knowledge of Native people became more aware to me. And I think I was sort of able to sort of see like, oh, right, we're not on television. We're really not in movies. There's like these, you know, moments of glory that we have, but it's very few and far between. Right. Northern Exposure was like another show that was on when I was a kid and there were Native characters. I remember it being like a huge deal for us. And then like, it was always a bummer, like in November, there was always like the Thanksgiving episodes of like, you know, these like random TV shows of like DJ Tanner would meet a Native American or something and it would change her life or whatever. And it was just always such a bummer because it was never, you know, how I saw myself or my family. And it was like once a year you'd get to see yourself. Yeah. I think that was like a weird, it was always weird when we were included, but like when we weren't, it was very easy to lose myself in the characters. Right.
And shout out to your hoodie, because I just see fry bread and I'm like immediately hungry.
there's a Kathy's fry bread truck is a truck on our show, and we had these hoodies made, and like I got so many emails from random people in my life being like, where's my hoodie? And I'm like, we haven't spoken in 10 years.
I just saw fry bread and I was just like, oh wait, yeah, that's on the show. But I was just like, fry bread, I like anything fried.
I love a fry bread.
Go ahead. Speaking, you know, to your culture, I mean, we're going to get into this later. And it's just so interesting about the Native Indigenous culture, because basically you haven't been represented, you know, in this weird way. But, you know, when you did throughout your career, you know, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Superstore, and all these shows, you know, even like there's not an inherent, like, you know, representation of Native people, but how has your own kind of upbringing, culture guided, influenced how you work, your career, even like diving deep into your storytelling and like what you wanted to say? How has it guided you?
Yeah, I mean, so many ways. Like it's kind of hard to say. I think Native people are not a monolith. Like even within, like there's over 500 federally recognized nations in the United States, which is not to speak of Indigenous people throughout the globe. And we're all different with our own religions and cultural beliefs and governments and languages. But for me personally, I think that one thing that I find fascinating about Native people is even within our own communities, you know, we are not a monolith. So like I have family who are hard Republicans, who are crazy, you know, not crazy, but like who are very much to the left, you know, who are very much, I have people who are vegan, people who hunt their own food. There's just so many different types of people have PhDs, people have GEDs, like, and so I feel like I was always able to really bring that perspective into any writer's room that I was in.
Yeah.
And that there was actually really like a diversity of background in terms of like, I have family who worked at Target and Walmart. So when I wrote on Superstore, it was coming from more of a place, or like I have family who were as religious as Glenn was on the show. So there was like, for me, it was important to bring like humanity to those roles and to those stories. So that, you know, because if my family was watching them, I'd want them to feel that way. Mm-hmm. So that I think is one big thing. I also just think, like I'd said before, like coming up from a family of Indian artists, I've always really had, you know, like there's a show my mom does once a year called Santa Fe Indian Market, and you weave or you make your art all summer, and it's one weekend and you never know how it's going to turn out. And some days it's amazing and you sell out, and some days it's terrible and you can't sell anything. And it's a lot of sort of up and down sort of feast or famine lifestyle that I grew up in. And that to me has always just been very similar to television writing. You know, mm-hmm. you never know when your show is going to get canceled. You can work on something you love and people just don't like it. You can work on something where you're like, I don't know how this is going to work. And then people love it. Like it's very erratic. And I've always been really comfortable in that environment just because that's how I grew up. And I do think like it weirdly made me very like primed for this industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh my God, like I was driving, cause I would go, you know, past, you know, cause I would always go to Burbank and I would always see the Superstore kind of Cloud Nine thing. And I recently drove past it and it's not there anymore, of course, but I was like,
I know.
I was like, oh no,
yeah. It's gone. No. I know. I wrote on the show for the first three seasons. And then was just a fan for the last three. Like I just always loved that show.
And that cast is amazing. And Nico, friend of the pod, fellow Filipino, you know.
Best.
He's so crazy. Yeah. But you know, like how was it for kind of, you know, getting your, I guess, foot in the door? Because this industry is like, you know, tough and, you know, it's hard to kind of just like get in. But how was it like in your early years? And how did you kind of measure yourself in terms of like, oh, what you can say, what you can't say, like, or just navigating it early on? And then like, now you have your own show. And it's, you know, I don't know if it's a long time coming or if you were just like, if you even envisioned this happening, but like how was it to, for you early on till now? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that having diversity in the room has really changed over the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I think that like the rooms that I were in early on, even when they were rough, were usually like more progressive than the other rooms of the time. Yeah. So I was very lucky to work in writers' rooms with multiple women, not just me and one other woman, or there was at least, you know, I think in like the early 2010s, it was like, if you were lucky, a woman of color and one Black male writer, and then a bunch of white people. It was like, usually I have so many Black male writer friends that I was like, oh, we were in this room together. And then, you know, it was like, that was sort of the recipe. For a really long time. Like I didn't work with a Black woman in comedy until I hired one, you know? So it's just like kind of a crazy, in terms of like the writer's room, there are other support staff and things like that. But so I think, you know, it's just really changed in the last 10 years. But at the time, it was like a very It was a great room. So like Happy Endings was a great room, but it was really daunting. I mean, there were 20 writers, give or take, because there were a lot of teams and there were a lot of people on deals. And so I had never done anything. I was working at the National Museum of the American Indian. I was a film programmer. I wanted to be a TV writer desperately. I took a class that taught how, I mean, I'd written scripts and I'd had all these samples and stuff, but I wrote 30 Rock to get into this program for Native American writers that helped kind of funnel people into the Disney Fellowship. Got that Disney Fellowship and then was like in a writer's room with people who had written on like Conan and like all these really talented people. And it was very daunting. And I remember just like not talking. I was just very quiet. I'd never felt more unfunny in my entire life. And I really felt funny, but I just couldn't speak for a couple of days. And then I remember like walking into Prentice Penny, who show runs Insecure, was a producer on the show. And I remember, I remember just going into his office because he was one of two other writers of color in the room. And I just remember being like, hey man, we're going to be best friends. So I need you to tell me what to do and you're going to fix my life. And he was like, I'm not going to do that. But he was like, but he gave me great advice. He was like, you have to talk. He's like, you have to talk. And then you have to contribute. And then he gave me the best advice of my career, which was basically the showrunners are the painters. And he's like, we're the paint. So he's like, figure out what color they think you are. And like, say you're green. When they need green, be green. But if they need red, just shut up and sit there and let the people who are red be red. So it's like, if you're a story person, come with those story fixes when they need them, but don't try to out joke the joke people, because those people are always going to be good at that. And then over time you can get good at sort of all the other things, but like really zone in on why they brought you in. Mm. And so that was just really helpful. I remember like in my weird converted garage apartment, like practicing pitches and like talking to no one, because it was really daunting to talk in this room of like 20 very, you know, boisterous, really entertaining writers. And then it was like every night I would read the notes and just make sure that something I said had gotten written down. And that was like enough for me for like the first 2 weeks. And then I started really trying to pitch and really trying to. So it was really about like knowing when to talk and knowing when not to talk. And I have one of those weird brains where I'm like constantly sort of, I don't know if it's my family, but like always trying to be aware of what people are feeling or thinking. And so it was easier to kind of, once I realized like, oh, a bunch of these people are also nervous you know, these people feel animosity in this way. And once you figure out kind of the power dynamics, you're sort of realizing everyone's kind of going through their own stuff and then really bringing that into the later writers' rooms that I was in. But it was rough. I mean, it's writers of color, especially at that time, were just not given the benefit of the doubt. I feel like it was, you know, if you were bad, it was because you were a diversity hire or because it was, you know, whereas I think there were white writers where, you know, if they had a bad day, they just had a bad day. And that was hard. It was hard. But I also think like, I just never, ever tried to acknowledge it. I was like in a weird state of denial so that I could just keep going. And those first few years, even though they were probably better than working in a lot of other rough rooms that I'd heard about at the time, it was always kind of having to just keep pushing forward.
And now you have Rutherford Falls.
Yes. So now you have your own show and it's dope. It is dope AF.
Right. Thank you.
So tell us, where did the idea for the show come from?
Totally. Yeah. I had written on Superstore for 3 seasons and was like, the network grind, like writing 22 was so, so daunting. And I had just had a baby. And so it was kind of, I stepped away from the show to kind of take a break and kind of figure out what I wanted to do with my next project. And then I got this call from my manager. I was telling them like, oh, I really want to work on something I think that like has a Native element to it. And he was like, oh, you should talk to Mike and Ed. They want to meet with you. He said, you know, they're working on this show. It's just like in the beginning phase. And so I was like, oh, definitely. So I met with them and I had worked with Mike previously on Brooklyn Nine-Nine for like a season. And I developed a show with Ed Helms, which was like a Cholo Simpsons. It was like this thing that didn't get made at Comedy Central that I really loved. And then, so I met with them and they kind of just had this idea for this character, really. It was like Nathan Rutherford and this town that he lived in and sort of his sort of themes that they were trying to kind of chase. And they said that we know we want to have a Native component because it's really about like, what is American history? And that's sort of the first story of America. And so I, you know, took a document they had home And I just was like, oh, this is like my life. Like, I know this character, his best friend should be Native. I just started like pulling from my life and my family, working at the Smithsonian for many years, working at many different types of museums and growing up in museums because of my mom. And I just like kind of vomited out all these ideas and they were like, yes, we want all of them. Yeah. And so then for like a year, we really worked on the pitch and we really had a lot of time to kind of, I was working on other shows while they were, you know, also doing the same and Mike had The Good Place. And so we just kept working on it and working on it. And it really was this like lovely collaboration where I feel like oftentimes, I feel like oftentimes writers of color are brought in at the end to sort of like quality control something that's already been created. And it's so hard if you're not there at the foundation level to explain why certain things don't work or why certain things have to go. And so to really be there at the ground floor with them, it feels like this beautiful kind of collaboration that we were all able to pitch on each other's stuff until it became this one cohesive idea.
Okay. And you know, obviously there's not that many, I mean, we talked about this before, but there's not that many things out there, TV shows, movies, web series, whatever, that do have Indigenous people at the forefront. And you guys actually use your talent are all Indigenous people, correct? I'm spacing on the girl who plays Reagan, her real name.
Janice Schmieding. Yes, yeah, Janice Schmieding is Native.
It was hilarious. Yes, Dubs.
She's amazing.
Michael Gray Eyes, who he's
a legend.
I love his character. I mean, the show is just has a bunch of color to it. It's super entertaining.
Literally and figuratively.
Yeah. And so I want to ask you, obviously, with creating the show, what was important for you to convey about, I know you mentioned that obviously this community is not a monolith, but what did you want to sort of convey about the community and about Indigenous peoples through this series?
Oh man, so many things. I mean, I think that, you know, we did not take the fact that we are basically the first show like this, a comedy anyway, lightly. And right. So we really tried to put, it was like, if we're doing this, let's do as much as we can in the 10 episodes that we have. So I think there's a lot of themes specifically about Native people that we wanted to kind of imbue. And one of the biggest one is really just like Native joy that, you know, I think that audiences, specifically non-Native audiences, kind of weirdly love to feast on like Native pain and trauma. And that isn't to say that like those stories can't be done well. I've seen, you know, working at the museum and the film program department, I saw many films and documentaries about, you know, our traumas that were done incredibly well and our works of art. But I think we rarely ever get to see Native joy and humor and the sort of, and really Native excellence. You know, I mean, my mom is like a master Navajo weaver and she's at the top of her game and she's surrounded by Native artists and there's PhDs and academics and just all different types of, and just even people who like my Uncle Ernie, who works for Fish and Wildlife, like he is Native excellence to me. Like I always looked up to him in terms of like how he led his life and the way he sort of organized himself and his family. And so I think that like Native people we live with our traumas and we live with our histories, but while we're holding and carrying that, we're cracking jokes, we're wearing incredible clothing, we're making incredible works of art. And so it was really about showing the different types of Native people. So in our writer's room, you know, including myself, we had 5 Native writers and a very diverse room beyond that. And we really wanted to show, you know, we'd have conversations in the room about capitalism or casinos or all kinds of stuff, crabs in a bucket mentality. And there would be this sort of debate. And oftentimes on a show, if you have a Native character, they're expected to sort of represent everybody. And so we were just really excited to have multiple Native characters getting to express different Native points of view and be funny, like just be mundane and funny. Like it shouldn't be revolutionary for that to happen in 2021, but it is, just because you never ever get to see, you know, people like us get to be, you know, just regular.
Right.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Lifetime's Robin Roberts Presents Mahalia.
From executive producers Robin Roberts and Linda Berman comes the biopic of the legendary Mahalia Jackson. Grammy Award winner Danielle Brooks stars as the trailblazer whose music moved, inspired, and changed people's hearts. Critics have praised Brooks's transformative performance into the Queen of Gospel as thunderingly good. Directed by Kenny Leon and written by Bettina Jilliwa and Todd Kreidler, this Lifetime original movie continues to inspire viewers and highlights the ongoing fight for social justice. Robin Roberts presents Mahalia for your Emmy consideration in all categories.
I have a question for you, because a lot of times, I know the thing about Hollywood and the reason a lot of times that they say that the lack of diversity is the case is because, oh, it's hard to find these types of writers, or it's hard to find certain types of actors, right? But was that the case for you guys when you were staffing your writer's room or finding your talent? Did you guys have difficulties finding Indigenous writers? I mean, I feel like there's just so much talent out there that it's like that excuse to me just never.
No, it's an excuse.
Yeah,
it's an excuse.
It never made sense to me. So
no. Okay. Yeah, I was told that for many years. Like, you know, I've been working over 10 years. And when I first got here, you know, I wrote a sample called Trading Posts, which is about these two sisters who hated each other running a trading post together. And, you know, it got me a lot of jobs. And I would hear from people like, oh, this is a great sample. It'll never be made. But like, this is a great sample, like, to get hired. And it was always just like, okay, well, you know, a lot of people have written personal samples that get made. And there was this sort of narrative that there's not enough infrastructure, there's not enough audience to support it, there's not enough talent, there's, you know, and we just did not find that to be true. I mean, we saw many Native writers. There were great Native writers who just weren't right for the show. Yeah. But I was like, oh, you should be on a CW drama, or like, oh, you should be on This Is Us. Like, there were so many Native writers that you know, we have this sort of like small list going that I always send out if anyone contacts me looking for people, like, oh, definitely hire this person. And so so we just didn't find that to be the case. And then, I mean, you have to go into community, you have to, you know, you have to pound the pavement. To go to UCB shows, you have to like do this stuff, but they're there, and you know, they might not be like on a list that an agent sends you, but like they are definitely there. Yeah. And you know, and then talent wise same thing, like we had so many amazing Regans, and I'm so happy. I think Jenna just completely knocked it out of the park. But when we were seeing them,
I would love her.
She's inspired. But you know, we would say like, oh, we can write a one line funny part for someone because we know this actress who can turn this joke or this actor. And you know, half of the people we saw are like in a Scorsese movie right now. So I think that there's, you know, clearly like it just wasn't the case. There was a little part of me that was nervous about that, and it just never really ever happened. So yeah.
I mean, I think
right, like stop with the lies.
I think it's just Hollywood's way of saying we're lazy, right?
Yeah.
They're like,
oh, really?
or they rely on the same Latinx person, the same Black person, the same Asian person over and over again. And if you even look at the you know, Academy Awards, you know, the three directors of, you know, Mexican descent or Latinx descent, that they've just been recycled. Alfonso Cuarón, Guillermo, and I mean, I'm not saying that they're not talented.
Right.
It's just that there's more out there. There's more, there's a wealth of talent out there. And Sierra, I liked what you said about kind of carrying that trauma and cracking jokes, right? Like, I think a lot of marginalized people have that same thing. And that's what I like about the story. It kind of strengthens that kind of point of view that a lot of us already have. And it's like, oh, see, this is not normal, but you know, this is like I just get proud. We had recently Anthony Ramos from In the Heights on, and how, like, I was telling him, I was like crying as soon as I saw In the Heights. I was like crying the whole time. And I'm not even of, you know, Latinx descent. I'm just like, oh, I'm just happy to see that this is here and that it's good and that it's excellent.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the way I feel about when I watched, I didn't cry, I laughed. especially with that one scene where they're like, I'll go chop wood. I was just like, oh. She's here to chop wood, right? And I was like, what? That scene is great. But, you know, since Rutherford Falls is, you know, pretty much the first like, Native series on a major network, as far as I know, like centering the Native narrative there, do you feel like that burden that comes along with being the only? And I know it's like the Native culture is not a monolith, just like the Black culture, the Asian, but it's like, I think a lot of us feel that when we are the only in a space that's dominantly, that has just dominated by white men. And it's like, all we feel like, oh, okay, we have to carry this. And you carry it so much that you burn out and then you quit, you know, that kind of feeling. But how do you kind of try to avoid that?
I think one is just being honest that that's what it is. Like my mom always quotes The Godfather, and there's like there's a scene in there where I think it's Hyman Roth is talking about the mafia, and he was like, this is the business we have chosen. And there've been so many times when I would call my mom and be like, this is at a hard day at work, and this guy took my pitch, and and I'd be in tears. And she's like, this is the business you have chosen. Like, is this your job or is this not your job? And I'd be like, this is my job. And she's like, okay, then go do your job, you know? And so I think a little bit of it is like, you go in knowing that. It's also like such a privilege. Like there's a fridge filled with snacks. There's like a million perks to this job, you know? So it is like, it's very stressful, and it can be difficult, but I also am just like, what a dream. Like, this is such an amazing opportunity. And so like, right now I'm sort of vacillating between being overwhelmed by the sort of love that we've gotten from Indian country. I mean, it's just been coming in. The people are making merch, people are making their own Kathy's Fried Bread sweatshirts. People are making jokes and memes, and they're painting earrings with Michael and Jana's faces on them. Like, it's just amazing. So that's like, I feel like Native people, we show our love through merch. So like, there's just so much great stuff being created right now. And so that has just been a wealth of love that has been so overwhelming and just really lovely. And then there's also this sort of bittersweet feeling of, this was a long time coming, and I should not be the first. That there are, you know, Native comedians like Charlie Hill, who in the 80s like should have had a show and should have, you know, and Paul Mooney should have showrun it, and it should have been awesome. And it's just like, I don't know. So I always say, you know, we didn't get this chance because we were the best. We got this chance because that's what happened. But we should have had shows, you know, beforehand. And so there's a little bit of that kind of mourning of all that lost time and lost talent, while also trying desperately to really get as much done as we can. Like, there's that scene in the movie Goonies where I think like Sloth is like holding up this rock to like let the kids escape.
He's trying to get
as many kids out before it falls. And that's sort of how I feel. I'm like, I'm trying to get as many shows made. I'm trying to, like, you know, we hired all these Native show like writers who I think could be showrunners. And it's like, jobs, we get jobs, right? And so, so to me, it's not a question of like burden. It's like, we have so many stories to tell that no one has ever heard of. I mean, I'm sure from both of your communities, like there's certain things, you know, we would mention like crabs in a bucket, and like the non-Native writers or the white writers, like on our show, like didn't know what that was. And you're just what? Like, these are things that, you know, are such a big part of our lives that we haven't even gotten to showcase. And I don't know. I just think like, it is hard. It is difficult, but it's the business I have chosen. Like, I don't know any other job that I could do. So it's either this or like I go back to Lane Bryant and start selling dresses again. Like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do.
Hey, Lane Bryant.
Come on, Lane Bryant. I used to work at a call center called Bry Lane. And I didn't work on the Lane Bryant branch. Like, there were other, you know, properties. Like, I worked for Chadwick's of Boston. I don't know if anyone knows that. I would sell sports sets. I would sell sports sets. So, you know, in multiple colors. But no, yeah, I just think it's exciting. Again, it's like, I may not be, you know, I'm probably not the only one. I'm like ignorant of the Native culture.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know what to say sometimes. I don't know. And it's like, oh, this is how we learn. This is, you know, how we kind of reach and like ask questions and watch, you know, through comedy. But it's like the Native community has been invisible, not just in the TV and film realm, but like in, you know, everywhere, yeah, basically.
No, and, for sure. I mean, yeah, it took us, you know, 20 days to get rid of Rick Santorum.
And get, yeah, right.
CNN. Yeah. And it took way too long. And, you know, and even now you're reading articles where like certain like Native people aren't given credit. I mean, Crystal Epahaka Aluma Natives and so many other Native organizations, National Congress of American Indians, like they all worked so hard to get him taken down. And like, it's like, we're not given any credit for that. We're completely being erased from the narrative of that. And it's frustrating because you're like, that was activism at work. Like that was people working and organizing together and creating community to create change. And it is hard. It is interesting watching that kind of happen where even when you are doing things of note, sometimes it's not always noticed.
I just think like ignorant doesn't mean that I'm stupid or like, you know, it's just that you don't know. And that's also what the industry has fed us through the inception of Hollywood, these images of Native people that we're all, oh, that's how it is. Right. And it could be same for Black people or, you know, the same for Asians. It's just like that just constantly has been a problem and it's impossible to undo, right? It's like, there's no way to undo it. And people are, well, yeah, we can't undo it. We just
need to teach. It's impossible to undo.
Yeah.
I think you can teach it out of people. I think, you know, I mean, we talked a lot about that in the room that like, there's a scene where Dana Wilson's character, Mayor Chisenhall, is fighting with Terry's character. And she's like, oh, I'm the angry Black woman. And he's like, I didn't say that. And then he's like, oh, I'm the tricky, shifty Indian. And she's like, I didn't even know that was a thing. And he's like, it's a thing. And that was because I was, you know, one of the things we talked a lot about in the room is, you know, there are Native stereotypes that Native people are exhausted by that I think non-Native people don't even know exist. Mm-hmm. And so it's like this hard thing of trying to make people aware of this stuff. Like I was always very nervous, as were many of the writers on staff, about having the Terry character seem complex and have, and really all of them. I mean, like we didn't want to flatten Nathan and just write him off as like the bad guy because he wasn't. Mm-hmm. And it was like, I find that in my life, things are complicated and you like constantly have to hold two things in your hands at the same time. Yeah. That a character like Terry could be such a champion of Regan and could also really dismiss, you know, the mayor, that people can have such humanity in their lives and also be adversaries to people. Yeah. And so, but so much of that is because I think when you show characters of color, they're rarely getting to be complex or funny or interesting or have a backstory or, you know, clear motivation. Like so much of our images that we see of ourselves is just to help this like white protagonist move forward in the story, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
We had many,
Oh, no, go ahead. I was interrupting.
No, we just had more than one Native actress, you know, say like, oh, it's so cool to like, I'm going to live at the end of this episode. And you're just like,
right? What?
And they would say like, yeah, no, usually when I'm on television, you die by the second act to like, you know, help solve the mystery or you've, you know, your part has been played. And so it is really crazy that is like such a norm.
Yeah. And I think it's just joyous to see any like POC, queer or whatever, you know, multiple ones in a scene without them having to explain themselves. So, you know, you see that in Pose, you saw that in Fresh Off the Boat, you just see it and there's something refreshing there. And I'm like, oh, aw. You know, I was like, oh, this is, and it shouldn't have to be, it should be normal, right? It's like, oh, we should be able to see these stories. And it's like, I was watching, you know, when I was watching the show, I was like, it made me think about Parks and Rec, you know, and there is a Native character in there, but how they sculpted it, I was all, this is interesting. And how, like, I remember there's one line that the character was all, white people love Rachel Ray and curses because they're just playing off of, you know, the ignorance of these people. But I just, I'm glad that a show.
I think the joke is, I know two things about white people. They love Rachel Ray and they're afraid of curses.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, it's my very, it's a good joke.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, that actually is good. And I was like, oh, I wonder if Rutherford Falls, if they would actually have a crossover with Pawnee, that would be interesting.
See, my thing is like, Native people are so critical, rightfully so, myself included, of fictional tribes. So I only want one fictional tribe on our show. I don't want multiple fictional tribes. I was like, we can't do that. But that's the line for me.
What's next for you, Sierra? I saw an announcement for season two. Is that still in talks?
Yes, we're still waiting for season two. I think because it's streaming, they have to analyze data and put it through some robot that I don't understand. So we're very much so. It's been so great to have opportunities like this and have people be tweeting about the show and talking about it, because it really does matter. And they're sort of analyzing all this stuff. And then we're just waiting. I'm working on a show right now, an Apple show, just kind of hopped on to help a friend. And I've been really enjoying that experience. Yeah. And what's crazy is there are multiple African-American writers and, both women and men. And it's just been lovely, because I do feel like it's this weird, now I'm like the seasoned older writer coming in on this show, and the diversity on the show is incredible. And it's also just like, it's just very organically, I don't know how to say this, but it's a show that I've really just enjoyed learning from younger writers, and really everyone's so funny, and it's just been a really wonderful experience.
Yeah. Well, if for people who haven't seen Rutherford Falls, please watch it. It's so good. We need a season two.
It out in the world. Oh, season two. Yeah.
Yes.
Peacock.
Manifesting.
Can you still watch without a subscription?
I think you could watch. Some on paywall, right? Some of them are behind a paywall.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So there's three episodes for free if you download just like the basic level of Peacock. Okay. There's a 7-day trial if you haven't already subscribed to Peacock. So you can binge it during that 7-day period. Okay. And there's like a medium tier, and then there's like a premium tier. So the medium tier, you have to watch commercials.
Yeah,
what I have. I have not.
That's what I have too.
And then I believe if you have a Comcast subscription, like if you have a Comcast internet, you can get a free Peacock subscription.
Okay.
There you go.
There you go, people. There are options.
There's options, you guys. The ads one is only $4.99 a month.
And the ads aren't even that bad. They're like probably a minute long. Like they're not that long.
We grew up with commercials.
Yeah.
You guys who didn't grow up with commercials, you guys just need to get used to them.
It's very retro.
Not that bad.
And it's all internal commercials, so it's not like it's like promoting Saved by the Bell, the series, which is also good.
Good.
People have some
good Girls Five Ever.
Yeah.
I need to watch that still.
Has some gems. Okay, so we like to sort of wrap up the interview with this segment we call the facts or the FAQs, just fun random questions to end the interview with. So your first question is, if you could erase one TV or films, one film, or TV series in the history of Hollywood's misrepresentation of a marginalized community, what would it be?
Oh man, that's so rough.
Yeah.
I know. There's like,
this one is hard.
There's so much dead air right now. Can you repeat the question?
Okay, so if you can erase one film or TV series in the history of Hollywood's misrepresentation of a marginalized community, what would it be? I mean, there's a lot of things that they've misrepresented. Like we can think of.
I know there's so many. Yeah. It's
Scarlett Johansson movies.
Ghost in the Shell.
I mean, there's so many. The top of my head, but now I feel like I'm being offensive in remembering this. But I think Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's. Because I only have seen that footage from this movie called Dragon, the Bruce Lee Story. And I was obsessed with that movie. And I was obsessed with Bruce Lee for many years. And I was like, anything that makes Bruce Lee sad, I just don't want to exist in the world. And then also, if that didn't happen in the movie, I could watch Breakfast at Tiffany's.
I think he actually came out and said that he regretted, or the director came out and said that they regretted that character.
But how many years later?
It's a doozy.
It was, yeah.
I'm just like thinking, I'm along the same lines. I would want to get rid of Long Duk Dong in 16 Candles. And I think if you got rid of Long Duk Dong, period, the story doesn't get affected at all. Like, it could just live on.
Yeah, it really doesn't.
Yeah, because that is the one thing that has haunted, you know, Asian culture forever, and it will forever be there. And that's, you know, what did they say? Pain is temporary, celluloid is forever. So it's like, that's true. Okay.
That is so, like John Hughes movies. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. John Hughes movies have problems.
I loved those movies as a kid. And then as I watched them growing older, I'm like, it made Chicago look like The Walking Dead or something. Like it was just, it was such a crazy like storytelling structure. But yeah, what can you do?
Yeah. Yeah. Have you seen that documentary Looking for John Hughes or whatever? Trying to find John?
Where is it?
I think it was, I want to say it was on Netflix. It may have like been taken away, but it's just about these two guys. Cause you know, John Hughes was very, you know, kind of, he was a hermit.
Elusive.
Yeah. So they tried to find him and meet him, and they even went to his house and everything. It's weird, you know, just to even go to his house. But yeah, I don't know what it's on, but I think it's called Looking for John Hughes. I might be wrong, but okay. So Sierra, I see you on the Twitter a lot. We tweet back and forth once in a while.
we do but, indeed.
In one word, how would you sum up the internet?
hellscape.
That is correct. It's that is the correct answer.
That is the right answer.
Yes. Even when I love it, it's killing me inside. Yes. So yeah.
Internet is killing all of us.
Yeah.
okay. What's the most embarrassing thing you've ever worn on your own free will?
Oh my God. How much time do we have? I used to wear these insane like white leather cowboy boots with fringe. And I'd wear them everywhere. And like one time my family was like, we're gonna be in the snow, so you need to put on some boots. And I was like, gotcha. And I like wore these like white leather cowboy boots in the snow, and I looked like an idiot. But I thought I looked so cool. So that was the worst part of it.
Fringe is good. You know, let's, you know, I think
it can be. There was like a silver buckle. Okay. There was a lot going on in those boots.
Were there like, was it bejeweled too, or no jewels or anything? Like rhinestones?
If I could have, I would have. There was like a silver buckle, like a silver button. And it was too much. It was too much look for a sixth grader, for sure.
Sixth grade. I thought this was like yesterday.
Yeah. No. This is as a child. Like I wore them until my feet grew out of them. And I'm so embarrassed.
Amanda, what do you have anything?
I honestly don't remember. I mean, I can't remember. I've worn a lot of embarrassing things, but.
Like the early 2000s was a rough time for all of us, right?
Yeah.
Like
it was rough. Yeah.
Like I've been watching things like we really love the bootcut jean embellished.
Yeah. Love the bootcut.
Low rise.
All that stuff's coming back too. All the like dress over jeans is all coming back. Oh. And like skinny scarves, those like skinny, like wrap around 40 times scarf. It's all coming back.
It is
crazy. Oh,
gross. Like bejeweled bandanas. I had a lot.
I know. Because
when NSYNC wore them, I was all, ooh, I'm a pop star.
I remember that.
Yes. I am excited to get like a Juicy tracksuit because I feel like I can afford it now. Yes. Like back when they were big, I couldn't afford it. And now they'll have my size. Like it's going to be better the second round. I feel like we're.
I'm going to get one too, actually.
I don't mind those.
I'm fine with that.
It's the, like, if you look at red carpets, like from the MTV Movie Awards from like, you know, 1999 to 2000 and some odd something, they were, remember the Britney and Justin Jean denim matching situation?
That's iconic, honestly. I still like that look.
I do too. It.
Okay, I live for a denim moment. I mean, yes. You know, what? Okay. So, okay. What do you consider classy now that you once considered trashy? You can't say the fringe boots because that was already an answer.
Oh my goodness. That I once considered trashy?
Mm-hmm.
That's a hard one.
I think That's a hard one. I don't think I ever, I love everything trashy. Like I love like,
well, what I mean, do you like? That's like rockabilly. Really okay, good, good.
I mean, I love like a cat eye makeup and like rockabilly chola kind of influences children. Like that will never leave my blood. So I don't know if that's trashy, no, but like not. Like Dolly Parton hair, like all my aunties had these like cow pile haircuts and like winged eyelashes. And I just thought they were so glamorous and we were all trying to be Dolly Parton. So, I mean, to me, that's like, the goddess of trashy and that I'm always trying to get to that point. So
Dolly is like the epitome of clash trash. I mean, not even trash, like, you know,
like eccentric, I would say, like maybe
eccentric. But she said like she was like obsessed with the like the town, for lack of a better word, like the town tramp. She was like, that woman had high heels. She was like, I want to look like her. And that woman, and her mom was like, that woman is trash. And she's like, well, I want to be trash. Like she was fully into it. And look at her now. She's freaking curing COVID. So
yeah, she was like all Moderna. Come through Moderna and Dolly. I want to just meet her. I just want like her to hug me and tell, you know, me that everything's going to be okay.
Yeah,
like,
don't you feel like so comfortable?
She's like,
I feel like she has like,
right.
She's the best.
Yeah.
We had a big, we had like a larger Dolly Parton storyline in our finale that got cut just due to COVID restrictions. We had to like shut down. And so we weren't able to finish filming it. And then when we came back up, we truncated it and it got lost. But we stand Dolly. We love her so much.
Well, hopefully season two, Dolly will become a guest star.
Guest star. Let us put it out there too. Okay. Would you rather brush your teeth with soap for 2 minutes or drink a carton of sour milk?
Drinking a carton of sour milk sounds like some like LA thing that people are going to be doing in like 3 months, but most native people are lactose intolerant. So I don't drink milk even when it's fresh. So I would definitely brush my teeth with soap.
Less egregious. I could 2 minutes.
Brushing your teeth with soap.
Yeah.
Because I just feel like if I drank the sour milk, I'd just vomit it. Like, because it's so bad.
And then you actually, once you get sick, wouldn't that make you sick? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, so can the soap in your mouth, right? I would think I'd throw up either way. You're going to throw up either way.
Exactly.
Okay. So the final question, Sierra, is there an underrepresented voice in the industry, whether it's an actor, writer, producer, creator, that is not getting enough shine that you think people need to know about and deserves more recognition by Hollywood? You could have multiple answers, one answer, anything. People,
just anybody that's maybe just not in the mainstream that is like coming up and comer.
Or someone that's been around for a long time and just hasn't gotten their due. Mm-hmm.
You're talking about a person that exists, not like a type of person.
Yeah. A person that you have worked with or you know or you admire.
Yes. Hold on 1 second. Let me just make sure I have the correct yes. Okay. So there's a native filmmaker named Rizelle Benali, and she is at NYU. She's in grad school right now, and she's incredible. And I think she's incredibly smart and thoughtful. And one of her professors is Spike Lee, which I just am like so jealous. I would love to have one of my professors be Spike Lee, but she is coming up and I think she's going to be huge. And I think she's amazing. So if you see that name on any kind of list, grab her, because she's amazing.
Her name again?
Rizelle Benali.
Rizelle Benali. Oh,
that's who I would
shout out
for sure. Yeah. But there are eons. There's eons. Carly Malmute is another incredible native writer. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, like, you know, like Azu Dungi, who works on Girls Five Ever and Lucas Brown Eyes. And there's a lot of like, you know, native people. And like, just to shout out the people on my staff, Tyler Clare, Jana Schmieding, Bobby Wilson, Tazma Chavez. They're all like incredible native writers. But yeah, I would shout out. There's like a lot of young people coming up that are, I think, I just hope like, have a third less hangups that they have to deal with because of what we're doing. But I'm so excited to see the stuff that they're making, and it's going to be great. Yeah, and also too, Sterling Harjo, Reservation Dogs coming out. I think they're wrapping today, and that was
nice.
Like, yeah. I'm so excited. It's like so exciting to like see a show with native people that you didn't make. So you don't have to think about the mistakes and stuff. You can just like, enjoy it as a viewer. Yeah. So I'm so excited to see his show. And you were saying like, how do you deal with the burden and stuff. And I think it is like building community with your peers. Like mm-hmm. I'm a part of a group called Untitled Latinx Project, which is a group of like female Latina showrunners. And then also just this native community of writers like Sterling and Tazba and Jana and Ty and Bobby, that it's been really nice to feel like there are people you can lean on, you know, and that can lean on you through this whole experience.
Well, we love to see it. Like, yes. It's just, it kind of like, I always say, like, when one of us wins, we all win. So I'm just like, you know, anything we can do or like that, to help bolster voices, you know, that have always been put in the margins. It's just like, I just love seeing brown, queer, black. I just love seeing it on screen. I mean, great, you know, white people, that's fine. You know, you've had your stuff. And like, no shade. I know it's on Peacock, but it's like when the Friends reunion was announced, I was like, oh, that's good. Let me go back to Rutherford Falls, you know, that kind of thing. But no, they're not on Peacock. They're on HBO Max. Sorry, guys. I got my streamers mixed up. Edit that out.
I would show up for a Living Single reunion, though.
I would. But haven't they been working on that?
And you know, the girl Kim Peele, who I think she left the last season. I guess she was saying she would do it. Like I saw an interview that she would be up for it. So like,
well, it would be amazing.
I saw a tweet. Earlier today. They were just like, "Oh, just have Marseille Martin be Kyle and Maxine's kid and base it off of her."
Oh,
wouldn't that be like perfect?
I would die. I would die.
Yeah.
Let's make that happen. This is the producing team right here. We're going to make that happen.
There we go.
I'm green lighting it.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you. And congrats on everything and just being you
and doing
release a fry bread cookbook. I'm down for that.
I'm going to do it. You don't want to see me make fry bread, but maybe my mom will do it. But thank you so much for having
thank
me.
Thank you so much, it. Sierra.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.